Well, thank you so much for joining me for this interview. It's a real honor and a privilege. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure.
Will
Glad
you
to be
allow
invited.
me to do a little bit of bio on you?
Sure.
So, Dr. Reggie Williams is the Associate Professor of Theological Studies at St. Louis University, in the College of Arts and Sciences. His research interests include Black theology, Black arts, African American studies, the Harlem Renaissance, Christian ethics, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer studies. He's the author of the award-winning book, Bonhoeffer's Black Jesus, Harlem Renaissance Theology, and the Ethics of Resistance, or an Ethic of Resistance. So it's an honor to talk with you about the Harlem Renaissance and Bonhoeffer's time in New York. To set the stage a little bit, let me give you a little bit of context. So, our church is beginning a series, a sermon series for Lent. And we've chosen the theme of Bonhoeffer's cost of discipleship. This is the second time we've done a series on Bonhoeffer. The first time was back in 2020, in the lead up to the 2020 election. And you can probably imagine why that was highly relevant in that season.
Right.
And while I was studying for that series, I read a bunch of bios on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but your book stood out among them all. In fact, it was the book that really enlightened me the most about Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life, and I think probably has the most relevance to where we are as a country right now. And so that's why it was extremely important for me to reach out to you in particular and to talk about Bonhoeffer.
Thank you.
As a place to start, one of the things that you taught me that I was like blown away by was how closely Bonhoeffer's theology actually aligned with the Volk theology of the German Christians before he got to New York. So, like when he was in Spain and he was kind of a pastor for expats, right? German expats. There was a lot of sermons where he was preaching on the Volk and the orders of creation. I wonder if you would set the stage for his transformation by saying, what was his theology like before he went to New
He was very folkish,
York?
very folkish, as as one can tell by reading him, which is not a big surprise that he would be that. And to say folkish is to say centered on the German people. The folkish movement was a precursor to what became National Socialism. To some degree, it was that. It certainly had the kind of German-centric, Germanic resonances, you might say, that was pop that helped to bring about, support for National Socialism in Germany. And he was sounding a bit like that in his pre-New York days. And it's just at this to set the stage for that. He was trained in theology in the post-World War I period. In that same moment, there was a lot of shame, there was disappointment, there was grief, there was inflation, there were fears of reverse colonization. There was anger at the November criminals, the people who signed the armistice while the military was still, fighting, as it were. I mean, thinking of fighting, or at least they may have been as well in battle. That's I'm exaggerating a bit, but and the no the November criminals also signed the Versailles Peace Treaty, which folks just felt like was such a shameful thing to accept for to put all blame for the war on Germany and accept a massive war debt that they'd be responsible for from 1919 well into the 1960s, in the context of crazy inflation, hunger, and depression. All of these things were happening in that period of time during which Dietrich was a theology student. So it's no surprise. And you know, the Nazis pick up, they start going in the 1920s, mid-1920s. And he finishes his dissertation in the 20s as well. I mean, he writes his habilitation shrift, the second dissertation, postdoctoral dissertation, just before he heads off to Harlem in 1930. So when the sermon that I refer to in the book is a sermon that he preached, I'm sorry, a lecture that he gave in Spain called Basic Questions of a Christian Ethic in 1929, where he sounds very folkish, meaning focused on the German nation and the German peoples with a preference for a German people over all other people as the center of, you know, affection and devotion and civilization and such, saying things like, for the sake of my folk, war can be sanctified, murder can be justified, so forth. So yeah, he was there, but he was a brilliant theologian. This first dissertation on the church and the second dissertation on the nature of revelation, and these were deeply theological treaties engaging with philosophy and sociology, and very technical, and all of that within the tone of a folkish centric folkish revival of the German people.
We sometimes like to think that our theology is sort of like independent of our political context. But what you're pointing to is that even Bonhoeffer, as brilliant as he was in a particular political context, and that did inform his theology very directly.
I mean, there's no question that the theologian has to, or the people who are engaging the theologian also need to pay close attention to the context in which the theologian is doing their work. No theology is apolitical. None of it is. This is one of the things that Cone taught us as well. People like to think about themselves as, or some would like to think about themselves. In specific, Cone was saying that white folks like to think about themselves as universal, objective, float above the world people, not tethered to any moment or history, and to be able to not contemplate politics is a political move. It speaks to one's context, one's social location, meaning where one is situated within society, within that what is continuously a hierarchy of being. To not have to think about being in your body in a political context and to think universal thoughts is a very political thing. That's a very political move.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's privilege, right?
It's
It's a
privilege.
privilege. Yeah. So this is
And I,
where.
just real quickly to say why that's privilege, because one is held comfortably within the grips of a political society that crushes some, yet is made for the comfort of others. So one can think about think theologically in comfort. One does not need to think to be concerned about the politics that harm many others. That's privilege.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of like the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? So at the very top there's like self-actualization, where like if you have all your basic needs met, safety and shelter and food, then you can kind of focus on like, oh, my own sort of self-actualization, right? My own thoughts, my abstract philosophy or theology. But when something as critical as safety is in jeopardy, that has to be at the forefront of it, of your mind. You
And
have to
you're
be thinking.
thinking theologically about safety.
Exactly.
You're thinking about the contextual embodied meaning of salvation.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So this is where the genius of your book comes in. So Bryan Stevenson has famously said, like, proximity, getting proximate to people who are suffering is crucial to understanding the world that we live in and the political system that we live in. And so Bonhoeffer spends a year in New York at Union Seminary. And this is where your book sort of zeroes in on how that time was formative for Bonhoeffer. Could you, I know that's the entire book, but could you speak to that that period and just what are some of the big influences and how did it shape him and transform his thinking?
It may be helpful to go back to that interwar period. And we say interwar now because we know a war, another war was coming. He didn't know that. But there's all of this pain happening in Germany. And what does a theologian say about such suffering, such pain, such grief? What, I mean, a theologian who recognizes that theology is the language of the church, this is what Dietrich was saying. Do you see a church where this makes sense, where attention to the lives of the community is actually being practiced? He's looking for a witness to that kind of engagement between the church and society. Does it say anything to the pain and suffering of the conditions that people know in those conditions people know in Germany? And in Germany, it didn't. It just didn't. So he comes to the United States and he's looking for that kind of thing. He finds something like the German church and a lot of white churches in the United States. Liberal theology, as one might put it, and Gary Dorian describes this as a halfway point between fundamentalism on the right and atheism on the left. It's a civilizing Christianity that speaks of the moral nature of a civilized society. But they're not, interested in talking about Jesus as much, and so forth. However, when he gets to Harlem, he encounters, now this is an important distinction for many folks who will study Bonhoeffer. Loving the idea of understanding and engaging with a German theologian, but have no clue what's happening in a black world. Black theology, black church, totally lost to them. They'll say silly things like he taught his followers, or the pastor of Abyssinian, taught the parishioners to be emotional in their worship. Silly things like that. There's a YouTube clip of Eric Metaxas wanting to highlight Bonhoeffer's experience in Germany, likely after I wrote my critical review of the Bonhoeffer movie, but wanting to highlight the experience of Bonhoeffer in Harlem, saying things like, instead of, this buttoned up, well-dressed, high liturgy, whatever, he says, he found people who were like loving Jesus, really emotional. And it's just ridiculous. And while they did love Jesus and they used that language, what he encountered there is the black social gospel. The black social gospel is the post-Civil War iteration of the pre-Civil War abolitionist faith. I mean, to say that they're just like emotional, they're emotive all the time and not considering the meaning of what it of their embodied life in a harmful world, is to betray one's complete foolishness.
Not
And
just reductionist, absolutely insulting.
it's standard. It's standard fare. And let it remain a mystery to the idiots. Just I would say to in that I mean that just that strong, but so one way to describe it is a recognition of a connection with Christ on the cross, not to highlight suffering, or or even to not to celebrate suffering, but to acknowledge that that the world puts people on crosses. And it's also it's an interesting engagement with the atonement. Did he go to the cross for or because of sin? One might say that he's put there on the cross because of a sinful world, of a sinful society, of a sinful neighbor community. And being on the cross is, as Cohen again says, the most apt representation of white racist Christianity is not the Savior on a cross outside of Jerusalem, but black people. You can say black and brown minoritized people placed on crosses to secure sacred white space in the country. That is because of sin. Jesus, the connection with Jesus in the black social gospel happens not risen with all power, but hidden in suffering, because and it's God is with Christ on the cross, then God is with black people on those crosses meant to secure white space, and we know Sunday's coming. He brings us with him to Sunday. That is the thought through gospel expression that Bonhoeffer met in New York, and this was represented in depictions of Jesus as black in the Harlem Renaissance as well. And here's what that means in the Harlem Renaissance. It's not a Christian movement by any stretch. And many of the people who are writing poetry about Jesus being lynched, depicting Jesus being lynched and so forth, they're not trying to bring people to church. They recognize that if you want to engage the harmful representation of humanity that is hegemonic and pushes people out of association with human, if you're going to do that, you need to address that sacred license, that sacred calibration that makes white human and human God, therefore white God. To represent Jesus as black is a recalibration of this notion of human being. This is being done by Harlem Renaissance artists and intellectuals. But then there are also people who are doing that. Not, I mean, they're doing that as a confessional move. It's theological outside of the church. It's kind of a political, public theological thing that's done not by Christians. But then there are some who are Christian who are doing that too, representing Christ in the suffering of black people. Powell is one who's doing that. Incidentally, County Cullen, a poet of the Harlem Renaissance, does something similar too. His Christ doesn't stay on the cross, his Christ is resurrected. And at the end of the poem, the Black Christ, he names that Jesus that he has poetically described as our brother, our family. O form immaculately born, betrayed 1,000 times each morn, as many times each night denied, betrayed, surrendered, tortured, crucified. It's a powerful representation of Christ in the family of black people. That's the message that Bonhoeffer encounters in Harlem. And one more thing about that. In 1930, Scottsboro Nine, the boy, those black young men in Alabama were arrested for dubiously, it was, of course, it was false, arrested for sexually assaulting a white woman on a train. They didn't know each other. The young men on that train didn't know each other. They knew, four of them knew each other, but the others didn't know each other. There was also an altercation with a white young man on a train, and the white young men got off the train at a stop and went and made these false accusations. At the next stop, the police arrested these boys. They took a statement from a woman who was trying to save her reputation as well, and rushed these boys through trial and condemned them to death. Dietrich heard about it. Most of the world had heard about it. He presses church back in Germany to join in the international protest. Theologian, political, social protest for harmed people. This is the kind of thing he's getting in Abyssinian. The church from Germany writes back and says, that's a social issue. It's not a gospel issue. We don't really deal with things like that. From his time in New York, and experiences like that, he's still writing about that when he's arrested in 1943. Actually, this shows up in his posthumously published Ethics, which he wrote in 1940, in an essay he's writing in 1942. It stays with him through the entirety of his public protest against Nazism.
Wow. So not only was it the proximity to the Black church tradition, but it was also this political climate that he's engaging with theologically. Now he's advocating on a political level for the rights and the freedom and the due process of accused young Black men. And that's shaping his thinking as well.
His theological reasons for fighting injustice that harms black people. You must say something about this church. That starts, he does that. He does that in Harlem.
That's huge. That's absolutely huge. Well, Roots is a community. We call ourselves a community of misfits, people from a lot of different backgrounds and walks of life. I wonder what you would say to a multiracial, multicultural congregation. What are some of the important takeaways from that Harlem Renaissance theology, that prophetic Black church social gospel, as you put it, the Black social gospel for today's political reality? So if you could draw the application, I know that's a whole big task, but there's a lot of parallels to where we are today in America, and probably there always has been parallels. So what would you say are the takeaways for that kind of congregation?
Some of the things that the civil rights, that the Harlem Renaissance was initially setting out to do, what some would describe as civil rights by copyright. It's arts, visual arts, begins with literature. It's got literature, visual arts, music, and some of those artists are Christian people. The other religions and sort of course, but the main thing is a public engagement with inhumanity, a public confrontation of inhumanity for the sake of healthy community, healthier community. One of them, the magazine of the National Urban League, which was developed to help Black people who were moving from the South to the North in the Great Migration, and it was titled Opportunity. Simply to make sure that people have the same opportunities. That's the meaning of that. The NAACP magazine is called The Crisis. It's the crisis of Black life in the country, the crisis of inhumanity, of injustice. Crisis from moving from crisis to opportunity. I mean, between these two publications, and this is where the Harlem Renaissance started, from crisis to opportunity. For the sake of healthy community. One might think of that, I would imagine, in your congregation as a message within the gospel that is con that is related to discipleship. What are the crises that we face? For people who see crisis primarily something like your eternal salvation, individual avoiding hell, fire insurance type stuff. And you'd say you don't have a big enough scope of the crisis we're facing. The gospel message meant to connect us back to each other, to God, and to the planet. This is the crisis, fragmentation, broken community. Injustice is one of those illnesses that are part of broken community. People incapable of connecting with each other in what we would describe as healthy relations. What Europe has done with regard to hegemonic notions of human being is to double down on that kind of crisis. And so we don't have the opportunities that we should have, all of us, opportunities to simply live and love each other. So one might say you can draw that kind of thing out of what's happening in the Harlem Renaissance, that our efforts to care for one another in healthy relationships and healthy ways, removing the obstacles that prevent that, is a public face of a deeper seated, just simple love for your neighbor, for yourself and your neighbor and God. And those of us who speak the language of the church with a confessional, with kind of a confessional faith hold on what the gospel means, how much more? Don't give in to the selfishness that makes, capital accumulation of wealth into a sacred virtue by thinking of avoiding fire for yourself to gain your mansion by the crystal sea. Well, that's not the gospel. That's not the gospel. It would be it's helpful to recognize that, the very positive witness that Bonhoeffer offers us, speaking that way, the positive witness that he offers us is our ability to care for your neighbor. That means apathy is not a possibility. Apathy is out. That means, of course, perpetrating the same kind of harms in the name of a Christian state, which they initially were engaging in, is out. No perpet Don't be perpetrating for the sake of a Christian nation. Don't be You can't be apathetic. The only thing left is to demonstrate your care for your neighbor by fighting the injustices that harm them. That's community. And that's what the Renaissance was. That's what he engaged in the Black social gospel. That's what the Black social gospel is.
Wow, I was gonna follow up with a question about an ethic of resistance, but I think you already outlined one. That really is kind of the heart of what it means to follow Christ and to resist the powers of sin and death at a local level. I wonder if you have any final thoughts, any kind of what is the most important sort of takeaway that you've gleaned from your studies of Bonhoeffer's transformative kind of awakening, his eye opening.
On one hand, I would want to highlight that he didn't figure it out completely. I mean, he heads into Harlem. He doesn't become a black expert, or an expert on the social gospel. He still remains a European white man who is pretty tethered to a colonial worldview. That's true. What he did see in Harlem was a call to push back against injustice that was theologically grounded, and it turned him into a pious Christian. What he writes after Harlem is more pastoral and engaging the faith as one who believes this, ha that b believes that this has a call on one's entire being, and that one, and he starts going to church even. He wasn't really going to church before Harlem, but when he gets back, church is important to him. Pastoral life is important to him. The faith is important to him. All inside of a witness against injustice.
Doesn't he say at one point, I became a Christian?
He wrote that to something. It was a cousin. Some say it was a love interest. But yeah, he says he says, I wasn't really a Christian before when he was working on this, when he did those two dissertations. But he became a Christian, engaging the Sermon on the Mount, he said. And that engagement with the Sermon on the Mount happened while he was interacting with harmed people. by politically oppressive regimes. So he didn't really figure it out, but we're all of us in process. None of us is a finished product. We are always already in progress. And so was he. The other thing is that just recently I posted something on Facebook about content that had become even clearer for me, teaching Bonhoeffer and writing about him in the context of our current political situation. He says that when Christ calls one, calls them to come and die, he makes suffering. And potential, the potential of suffering, and suffering itself, a concrete Christian, good. We need to pursue the cross. And I've always considered that as evidence of his, privileged status. Of course, there are people who are on the cross, as I said earlier, with no choice in their placement there. People can make a choice in suffering. They are in relative comfort in society. They're privileged. But then, as we're in this moment we're in, and recognizing many of us, that when you speak out on a regular basis, you could become a target of this administration. Fact. Some people are finding their jobs at risk. Many have lost jobs, but those who speak out against the curtailing of DUI, and those people who are doing work on diversity, equity, inclusion are losing jobs. Focusing on woke culture, as this climate places it, are in danger. Maybe not life-threatening danger yet, but they're certainly in danger of livelihood lost. That is what I understand him to be speaking about. That the Christian cannot sit in relative comfort or hide from a regime that is going after people. You can't hide. You can't sit in silence. That to be a follower of Christ in a moment like this means to risk, and means to put yourself at risk for people being harmed. And he made sense. That makes sense to me in a way that it hadn't yet.
Wow. Thank you so much, Dr. Williams. This has been a an honor to conversate with you about Bonhoeffer. I really think that what you've shared is going to be really meaningful for our congregation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, dear brother. Thank you again for the invitation, and blessings to you all, brothers and sisters.